if they do but one bump of Trump, they will become addicted. But one bump, Trump of bump. Now, if you think about the Trump bump and doing Trump bumps, what happens is it rewires your brain. It creates a sense of euphoria.
Yes.
Now, it'll create a hangover the next day, and you will feel brutalized. But what happens after this bump is your ratings go up, and it's going to lean your coverage to positive because you want more Trump bumps.
Yep.
And he brings the bumps. You know, he comes, you know, there's going to be five bumps per, you know, every half hour. Right? You're going to be doing 10 bumps an hour. It's pretty intense. You know, like this is going to make Keith Richards and Kate Moss jealous. Like this is a lot of bumps. Elton John is going, whoa.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Google for Startups. Accelerate your startup journey with the Google for Startups Cloud Program. Get up to 200K in Google Cloud credits or up to 350K for AI startups, plus training and guidance. Apply at startups.google.com/twist. Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. And Assembly AI. Get maximum value from voice data with Assembly AI. Build powerful products and features for your end users on the industry's leading speech-to-text models. Get 100 free hours to start building at assemblyai.com/twist.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm back, Alex. As you know, I got COVID.
Yes.
Pretty brutal. Luckily, we had a lot of banked episodes. We always bank 3 or 4 episodes. And you did a great episode where you interviewed 3 members of the Twist 500, the 500 most important private companies in the world. Well done.
Yeah. Huntress, Sierra, and Tollbit. So a couple cybersecurity companies and one company that wants to aggregate essentially media companies to kind of put their data together and license that out to AI. Really a lot of fun. I love talking to founders. It was actually 4 different Twist 500 interviews over 2 shows. Because we also had the Gusto chat with Josh Reeves.
Nice.
He's interesting. You know, we have a lot of folks on the show kind of show up. You can tell they're caffeinated. Woo! Where you're like, hey, you know, fight and kick it up. His style is so much more like, I'm building for 20 years. We're going to go. That's our direction. We're going to roll. And so you almost want to like nudge him into saying something a little bit spicier. But he's like, no, man, my model works. We're a $10 billion company.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
Gusto is amazing. I mean, I've used it now in of my own companies, a couple, and just great product. You know, that whole space of payroll combined with HR, it's just such a great category. I can tell you 20, 30 years ago when you started a company, it was just a pain in the neck because you had to have an office manager, an HR person, real estate, signing a real estate lease for 3, 4, 5 years, putting down 1 year of rent and what's called a letter of credit. All of this equaled about $500,000, you know, when you were starting out, right? In an accounting department. So it was very strange. Now, the idea that you would hire an accountant in-house, an HR person in-house, have real estate holdings, have leases, it's just all been abstracted. And that means more people could start companies and get to product and focus on product more. So it's just great change.
Just to throw in one more point about that, I love going back and reading books about startups in the 90s because they say things like, well, we had to raise a bunch of money to go buy servers. And I'm like, oh, right. And then they debate co-location fees and worry about their uptime. And, you know, you never hear of a founder who's gets woken up at like 3 a.m. to go fix the servers because Amazon's on it or Azure's on it, you know? It would be interesting to see how many different expenses that a 1996 internet startup had that have now been completely abstracted to the point of being either an API or a managed service. Half?
Yeah, it's definitely $500,000 to $1 million per year of operating spend in dollars from the 90s and 2000s less. So you're correct. The first company we had, we wanted to do email and we had the Silicon Alley Daily newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
This is before there was Substack and MailChimp. So what we did is we set up a bunch of Qmail servers in the closet and it was about $40,000 worth of them. We got a dedicated T1 that was $15,000 per month. But I put all that together and it was probably, and then we had a sysadmin, my friend Brian Alvey set it all up for us. So you're talking about $150,000 a year to maintain this probably between people and costs, et cetera, or more. No, maybe $200,000. And, but we said, we're going to make $10,000 a week in advertising. That's $500,000. So we'll break even you know, when we get to the 20th week of the year, 30th week of the year, everything else could potentially be profit. So it's just fantastic that you can go faster.
And it's so cheap. Like MailChimp, cheap, Substack, free. I really think that deep in my brain stem, that software is too cheap by a factor of 10 compared to like the productivity people get out of it compared to the old costs.
I mean, if you were to just look at the power of email, we use Beehive now for the Twist 500, which used to be called the Ticker, and we use Coda for the database. Mm-hmm. And if you were to do this in another era, you know, it would have been $250,000 in, you know, software developers to build that platform, or in the client server era, you know, $50,000 to buy the server software and you would sign a 5-year deal. So $250,000 for 5 years. And now, you know, you talk about hundreds of dollars. And even, you know, MailChimp, I loved MailChimp. We used it for a long time. But, you know, for newsletters, which are free, Beehive became and Substack became better options, I think, for people because they're free. And free is a pretty good price, or close to free, you know, essentially free. Even the paid version of Beehive, or what you pay in 10% of your, you know, paid subs to Substack, it's such an affordable fee that more people will use those products. Therefore, they make up for it in volume. So good on technology.
Yeah. Okay. So we didn't mean to start here. We have other stuff that we actually have notes on and plans
tons
for.
Tons of stuff. We haven't talked in 2 weeks. So you had a nice break, I take it? You had a little vacation?
I did. I went up to North Massachusetts to a lake and a cabin and a golf cart. My first time ever with a golf cart.
Nice.
It's just an adult go-kart. It's amazing. It was so much fun. My daughter loved it. And it was just a blast. I now have decided that we need to redraw all American cities, strip out all the roads, replace them all with golf cart tracks, and we should all just be cruising with 1 foot out the, you know, out the side at like 11 miles an hour while drinking coffee or a margarita. It's great.
I love a certain speed, and the speed I love is somewhere between 15 and 30 miles an hour. This is what an electric bicycle goes. When I had my Vespa in New York, you know, it was topped off at 35. I had a little small one. And I do like that. I like that speed for cruising because you can take things in. You get where you're going. You're not like zip, zip, zipping, but you're kind of zipping. And it's a nice feeling. I'm a fan of that mid speed.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on this. This is why I think when you're on the highway going 75, it's so boring because you can't actually focus on anything. So you see nothing. But if you're going 15 or 20, you can see every single squirrel, rabbit, dog, you know, it's with you. So what we're saying, friends, is go out there and touch grass. But on the show today,
lots of good stuff.
Lots of good stuff. Jason's unified media strategy / the Trump bump. Then WeRide's IPO, Polymarket and Perplexity, everyone's two hottest companies out there today to chat about.
Yeah.
A bunch of money going to Europe and venture capital. I don't know how to intro this other than saying that something happened last night that a great many people tuned into. And you had a thought or two about it.
Well, Elon did an interesting conversation with Trump, and he pitched it as a conversation as opposed to an interview, which I think is similar to what we do on All In as well, which is it's a conversation as opposed to an interview where one person is preparing questions and knocking the other person off base kind of thing. But they went for 2 hours. There was a lot of like hand-wringing and prognostication afterwards. And people are wondering why there was such a strong reaction to it. Okay, I'm sure you have feelings. You and I are both media guys and tech guys. So we have a lot of opinions on these things. I just want to point out, you know, what I've experienced firsthand with Trump and that I've been talking about for a couple of years, which is the Trump bump. Mm. I believe anybody who has a media property, if they do but one bump of Trump, they will become addicted. But one bump, Trump of bump. Now, if you think about the Trump bump and doing Trump bumps, what happens is it rewires your brain. It creates a sense of euphoria.
Yes.
Now, it'll create a hangover the next day, and you will feel brutalized. But what happens after this bump is your ratings go up. So when we had Trump on All In, you can just look at it statistically. I think it probably added 50,000 subs. In other words, 10% more subs to the YouTube channel.
Those
episodes went straight to the top. And you can see the Trump bump for weeks afterwards, where people are still coming back to that episode. It, you know, it kind of lingers. I think it's probably got 1 million or 2 million views on YouTube alone. So then your mind as a person with a media property is, well, when can we have Trump on again? And This is the, there's the Trump interview. I don't know. What does it say there in terms of how many million views? Okay, 3.1 million views.
There you go. And
it's a month old. The average all-in episode, I think, on YouTube, just the YouTube portion, is 400,000 to 600,000. So it's roughly five times. All right, everybody, you know, being at a startup is a team sport. You're not going to get there alone, man. You got your founders, you got the early team members, of course, investors. Most importantly, that first couple of customers, right? And you all work together to get your company off the ground. And I have great news for you and your team. Google for Startups Cloud Program is now a partner here at This Week in Startups. And listen, you all just want to know the number. Here's the number, 200,000. 350,000. These are the two numbers. What are these two numbers? You're going to get $200,000 in Google Cloud credits. And if you're an AI startup, you can get up to $350,000. Google is serious. Google for Startups Cloud Program is here on This Week in Startups. Just letting you know, they are serious about helping your startup. The number is the number, okay? And there's two great numbers here. 90% of generative AI unicorns choose Google Cloud. We all know that. They do a great job. So here's your call to action. You need to get these credits. You need to start building. You're going to find out everything about this amazing program, Google Startup Cloud Program, at startups.google.com/twist. Okay, very simple. Hit the rewind key, bookmark this, write it down. I want you to sign up right now. Pause the podcast because these are big numbers, folks. They really want to support you. I don't know how long they're going to do this for. So startups.google.com/twist. All right, let's get back to this amazing program. So when you see everybody doing this, there's two ways to go. You can either, if you have an avenue to engage Trump like Fox does or Tucker Carlson with his new independent show, Megyn Kelly, if you can get him, you're going to be nice to him. You're going to be engaging with him. And it's going to lean your coverage to positive because you want more Trump bumps.
Yep.
And he brings the bumps. You know, he comes, you know, there's going to be five bumps per, you know, every half hour. Right? You're going to be doing 10 bumps an hour. It's pretty intense. You know, like this is going to make Keith Richards and Kate Moss jealous. Like this is a lot of bumps. Elton John is going, whoa. Now you go on the other side, you're Rachel Maddow, you're anti-Trump, you consider him a threat to democracy, whatever. You're on the other side of the spectrum. You can't get him on your program, obviously. He's not going to sit, in all likelihood, maybe one out of 100 times. But you're going to get excited to, you know, if you write something critical, boom, all of a sudden your ratings go up. Now, MSNBC, Fox would be the two perfect examples, or maybe New York Times and Wall Street Journal. But I believe the media is so obsessed with Trump bumps. They're so addicted to the Trump bumps that there is a unconscious emergent behavior, which is, he fills so much of the room and you get so many ratings. You get paid subs on the New York Times, Guardian, and Washington Post. Remember, they were actually saying, if you want more coverage of Trump's crimes, like literally that was their pitch, subscribe. Help us cover Trump's crimes more. Like literally was in the marketing. So I think both groups are going to be responsible, if he does get elected again, for playing a big part in this. One group for engaging him, the other group for attacking him. Anyway, it's an underreported story, I think. And that's a lot of what happened last night, because the media business is a little bit threatened by the fact that sources are, you know, giving interviews, maybe not to mainstream media and going around it to more direct, you know, the direct aspect of it. It's a little threatening, but I think it's the bumps that's the major issue. What is your take on it?
So the last thing you said, a lot of people view the media world through their own personal lens, which is kind of grievance forward, that the media hates Substack because blah, 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 blah. The media hates, first of all, the media is the least cohesive, coordinated thing ever. So there is no media.
Right.
The other thing, though, is I think a lot of what you're saying about the Trump bump is correct, but I think it's more of an example of something that's a little bit broader and more common, which is the sheer power of celebrity. And I would say that the Trump bump that you're describing is similar to coverage of Taylor Swift, for example.
Sure.
I think also coverage of Elon himself. If you put Elon Musk in a headline, you will get a lot more people paying attention to you.
Yes.
And this becomes a thing that the media could better ignore or not pander to if they were in better financial straits. But right now, with social media no longer being an effective driver of traffic and attention, everyone's fighting for the same 4 boxes in a Google search window.
Yeah.
And so if all the people in the world are searching for Musk Trump or iPhone 17 or, I don't know, Musk Tesla or pick your thing or Taylor Swift concert, then you almost can't not do some of that because that's where the people's attention is going. So I put the Trump bump in under that kind of like broader umbrella.
Sure.
There is an example, though, to your point about people joking about wanting Trump to come back to be reelected because it'll help them. And the only example I can find of this was Axel Springer's CEO a couple of years back. He said this, and then he was like, oh, I was kidding, da, 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 da. And everyone was like, well, we know you guys. We know you actually want him back because it would be good for your business. But as a last note, the average journalist is, I think, concerned about having something akin to stable employment. Much more so than setting media policy on this level. But I'll cop to it. If 4 people got in trouble and 3 of them were well known and 1 of them was not, I know which one I put at the end of the headline because I would like people to read my story, which is clicks. But I think that's become a relatively cheap and low rent attack of trying to cover things that people care about. And I think that the media should do a combination of things people care about and also things that they don't care about yet. And that's why I read The Economist.
Totally well said. Yeah, totally well said. And I think, you know, a lot of things in life are financial. It's resource-based. And when you have competition, like the media does now, and it's death by 1,000 podcasts and Substacks and Beehives and, you know, Twitter handles and TikTok, you know, personalities, you know, it's literally death by 1,000 cuts, just like the networks experience when cable came out. And that is at the core of this. They can't afford to keep the lights on in many cases. That's why independent media is doing so well. Because if you do happen to find your niche in independent media and you keep your cost structure low, like, you know, This Week in Startups has 8 employees, I think, 3 in sales, 5 in production, me and you. I think it's 9 of us.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty big team, 9 people, but it's not 900, you know, it's not and 500 it's mouths to feed.
1/3 sales and 25% producers. I mean that's literally like bringing money in, keeping everything going, getting it edited, getting
and
it
two of us.
And two of us. I mean, honestly, I think we
couldn't be more bootstrapped, right?
I think you and I are the least important parts of the show, to be totally honest, because without the other people, no show happens. I want to talk about the actual interview, though. I tuned in for a little bit.
Yeah, I heard some of it. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I'm just...
Or the conversation. Remember, it's not an interview, it's a conversation.
Right, sorry.
Okay, so depending on your framing,
I just want to say that Elon's level of patience was greater than I expected. I tuned in during the nuclear power climate change thing.
Yeah.
And the former president said something along, I'm going to paraphrase gently here, that the sea level is only going to rise by 1/8 of an inch in 400 years, which is wrong by a factor of, I don't know, 50 or something.
Farcical.
And Musk, in his infinite patience, kept dragging him back to nuclear power. Like, no, nuclear power is good. And Trump's like, well, I heard that Fukushima is actually now on Mars. And Elon was like, I just saw as bad as you think. And he kept just, it was very patient by him.
I think, you know, Elon is not obviously an interviewer by trade, but, you know, he's a friend of mine and we've had countless conversations. He's a great conversationalist. And I think when you're interviewing the president and specifically that president, right, 45, having also had the privilege of doing it, one and only president I probably will ever interview, but you never know. I haven't really tried. He is got a playbook like a comedian, right? And one of his great skills is his ability with these anecdotes and comedy and a little bit of timing is like a routine. He got it from Howard Stern, actually, which was like a major media influence in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s in New York City. I was there for it. I grew up on Stern. Trump was a regular on Stern, and Trump loved Stern, like at his wedding type level of love for him.
Yeah.
You know, was really into him. And there's a famous moment inside of the movie Private Parts where Pig Vomit, who he named his producer, played by Paul Giamatti, is like, what's going on? And he's like, the ratings are up. He's like, how could the ratings be up? What are they saying? They're like, well, the people who love him listen for 70 minutes on average. And, you know, the average commute's 40. And he's like, why? Why do they listen? And he's like, well, number one reason given, want to see what he's going to say next.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, tell me about the people who don't listen. He's like, yeah, they listen for 95 minutes. He's like, what? they listen for 25 minutes longer. It's like, yeah. It's like, well, why do they listen? He's like, number one reason given, they want to see what he's going to say next.
Right.
Trump took that playbook, and it is why people listen. What will he say next? All right, founders, do you want to sell to bigger customers? Of course you do. You want to get that ACV trending up, 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 and to the right, average customer value. And you want to lower your churn, of course. And if you want to get to major buyers, you're going to need to clear those compliance checks. That means you have to have your SOC 2 sorted out. What's SOC 2? It's just a standard, and it ensures that companies keep customer data safe. If you aren't SOC 2 compliant, you're not going to get the big deals. But Vanta makes it so easy to get and renew your SOC 2 compliance. On average, Vanta customers are compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. And without Vanta, it's going to take months. Vanta can also automate compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, you know, and all these other acronyms that are boring and tedious, and it's hard work. And that's why you get a partner like Vanta. So it's easy peasy, lemon squeezy. You want to get the big customers, you got to have these acronyms all dialed in. And they're going to save you hundreds of hours of work, and they're going to save you like 85% on your compliance costs. It's that simple. And Vanta is such a big supporter of this program that they're going to give you $1,000 off at vanta.com/twist. That's vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2.
And it is effective, because I was watching political Twitter. I was also taking care of the baby. My wife had a thing, so I was solo caring for Ado's sleep schedule. But he called Gavin Newsom, Gavin Newscum. And that is such a petty, small-minded, unpresidential, hilarious thing that everyone loved. The flip side, though, is he does have an exposure problem, because he's been going out there on the campaign trail for so long now.
Yeah.
When I tune in, it's almost like you're going to like see the same comedy set for the third time. It gets a little flat.
It can
at times.
Be. You know what? If you do see a comedian do their shtick, and I see this with old people. Old people kind of run out of life experiences, so they tell the same 17 stories. You know, you go see your grandfather, and he's like, "Oh, you know, did I ever tell you about the fire that I ran to?" And I'm like,
"Yeah,
Grandpa." And he's like, "Let me tell you, we were there." He doesn't even hear you say that heard the story 17 times.
My dad is also in his 70s, and I have heard the story of how they redid their cherry cabinets in their kitchen probably 4 times. I'm probably going to get it 4 more times.
What I do like about that, though, is that it was something new. It was casual. And you have to ask Trump 2 or 3 times to get through his shtick, his bit, his anecdote, whatever it is. And I did that successfully, I think, twice in the interview. And, you know, I only had 15 minutes of the 60 minutes we had with him or something.
Yeah.
You know, but you saw when I got him I nailed him down on abortion, and I nailed him down on immigration. And then I was going to go January 6th, but we ran out of time.
Yep.
And I was firing off the last couple of questions trying to get him in. And, you know, I would have got him on January 6th as well, but you have to ask him 3 follow-up questions. And Elon did that last night. And I didn't talk to Elon about techniques or anything, but he did a very good job of bringing him back and kind of, but Spaces is peculiar because you also don't see the person and their reaction. In a normal conversation, we know when we're going to move on to the next thing. And because, you know, the person's like, okay, got it. You know, you have all kinds of techniques as an interviewer to, you know, move the conversation forward. In other words, to interrupt the person, to stop them. And you'll hear me on All In when I have to deal with my three partners who are, you know, like they all want to talk for 5 minutes each. And if they all talk for 5 minutes each, and now we got 3 5-minute monologues. And it really is a terrible experience for the audience when people do that. So I interrupt and I try to move the conversation, get the ball to move around. So one person is not Carmelo Anthony, you know, the ball, and they dribble the ball for 21 of the 24 second shot clock, which is just not good basketball. You want the ball.
I understood that reference.
So, you know, on the margin, some people will get mad at me because they're Sacks fans and I interrupt the Sacks, or they're Freiburg fans and everything.
Sure.
But when they get to 2, 3, 4 minutes, you know, like, okay, we should move the ball here. There was a little bit of that going on, which is very hard. Spaces is a little bit like a CB, and you don't see the person. So you're like, okay, tell me about your thoughts on the border. Over. But people don't say over. And so you could kind of step on each other a little bit with that kind of talk radio format.
Yeah.
What's great about it is you can pop it up. It's freewheeling. The limitation of it is you don't have visual cues, and it has a little bit of a CB radio. And I don't think either party were using headsets. So I got to talk to Elon. Really, what it has to be optimized for headsets. As much as people don't like to wear headphones or whatever, it would really help if they put in earpieces or had a stick microphone of some type. But anyway, those are technical issues.
Go in your child's room, find an iPhone case that's just laying there somewhere. Find the headphones that they never took out because they want to be cool and have AirPods. Plug those suckers in.
Oh, the old school ones.
It's free and it's actually B plus audio quality. And it's the cheapest and best way to simply go from talking to your phone like this, which I saw Trump doing pictures of him doing this space. And I wanted to be like, dude, come.
It's the worst. It's the worst for AV quality. I cringed. I was like, oh my God, he's on an open air microphone in a giant room.
Yes.
That's going to create distortions. And that's why I think it sounded a little bit like he had a lisp. Did you notice that? And people were talking about this lisp thing. And I was trying to figure out, is this like dentures, a lisp, or a little echoey in the room, or some combination of it? I never got the definitive.
If Trump drank, I would have said he had a scotch or two, but he doesn't drink. So it wasn't that.
He doesn't drink. So it wasn't it does sound a little bit like that as well. Like as if you were on drunk history and.
Just a little bit.
Like 5%.
It sounds like me after I've been to the dentist and they've numbed part of my face. So I'm going to put $1 on dentures, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to have if you are elderly. I'm not here judging. But also, if you are going to go on a space with a million people and the richest man in the world, and you're trying to run for the biggest office in the world, put on some damn headphones and fix your teeth. Like, I mean, come on.
If that was what it was. Yeah, but I didn't. I thought maybe I was hearing things or it was my phone connection. And then I saw the headlines and there was a large number of headlines that mentioned it as well. So anyway, overall, there's a lot of other news today. You know, where do you want to go in terms of the big news? I'm really fascinated with self-driving and there's some EV company. You and I love public companies. I'm fascinated with the tipping story. I'm fascinated with Uber's earnings and, you know, what's going on in self-driving. Where do you want to go today?
We're doing WeRide.
WeRide. I never heard of this company. What is this?
Jason texted me yesterday. He's like, hey, who the hell's WeRide? Why are they going public? What do we know about them? And I was like, well, I have the F1 filing up. I haven't read it. So I promise I go through and take a look for us. WeRide, it turns out, is a unicorn Chinese self-driving company, raised $1.1 billion, $5 billion valuation, is going public in the US this week. We haven't seen a lot of IPOs, Jason. We've been suffering from a lack of filings and kind of good listings. So we care a lot. And the company in this case is going to be raising a lot of money. The actual IPO itself is going to be about $100, $110 million, depending on underwriting shares and so forth. As you can see on the screen, they do quite a lot of different autonomous driving stuff, from robo-taxis up to robo-street sweepers, which...
Love it.
Yeah, as long as they don't run over my dog, I don't know.
Yeah, no running over dogs, that would be bad.
Yes, but also there's a concurrent placement of like 340, 380. So this is going to be a serious offering in terms of capital raise.
Okay, so we've never heard of this company. This leads into my theory about ride sharing. Now, I'm obviously still a big shareholder at Uber and believe in the company. I'm obviously a big Tesla fan. I don't own shares in Tesla, full disclosure. Very complicated for me if your friend is... CEO of that company and you have shares, you could,
I understand,
you know, get dragged into all kinds of craziness. So I just, it's not that I don't believe in the company, but
you own enough Teslas that everyone knows you like them.
I have four.
That's the two most anyone I've ever met.
Two collector's editions that I don't drive. Number 16 of the Roadster, number one of the signature Model S, is the first Model S ever available to the public. And then I have a Y and an X. And I've had the Y and the X since they both came out. So they're very old.
When you do your will though, can you leave me the Roadster? First one? Because that's
okay. I just have to, let me just change the will because I gave that to my oldest daughter, but I'll just switch that over to Alex. Got it.
Yeah, thank you.
Cross her name out.
That's the one that's based on the Lotus Exige?
Yes. Yeah. It's the orange one. It's amazing. So putting all that aside, there's a big question, you know, Waymo's impact on Uber and Lyft, Tesla having the robo-taxi event, I think in October or November, they pushed it back 2 months. My theory has always been there's going to be five players, to pick a number, that I think figure all this out at the same time. And by same time, I mean within an 18-month window. In other words, they all get there in the same window to exploit the opportunity, right? If you get there 3-4 years after Waymo, maybe you're going to be too far behind. But if you get there in the same 18 months of Waymo, I think you're good. And Waymo's there, right? And Waymo's been there for maybe a year of like really good, solid, no crashes. Thank God nobody's died. No major, you know, except for the hippies in San Francisco being like, it blocked you know, an emergency vehicle, then you look and it's like, it didn't block the emergency vehicle. Anyway, I see you like signing.
No, I agree with you on the hippies. I grew up in Oregon. I am familiar with the hippies.
You can smell them coming. Oh my Lord, podcasts, audiobooks, virtual meetings, endless videos. We're producing and consuming more voice data than we ever have. And if your startup is building a product that uses voice data, you need to check out Assembly AI. Assembly AI builds speech-to-text AI models that can turn your voice data into new product capabilities. All you need is voice data and a few lines of code. For example, VidIO makes video editing tools that generate the captions you see on our video clips, right? These are really cool. It saves us a ton of time. Well, that would not be possible without Assembly AI crunching all that audio data for VidIO. Assembly AI speech-to-text models are simple, accurate, and fast, and they've got the industry's lowest word error rate, 30% fewer hallucinations, and it's so easy to use. So if you want to put your audio data to work, and you want to build powerful AI experiences for your customers, head to assemblyai.com/twist and get 100 hours for free. And join over 200,000 developers who are building amazing apps with voice data. Go to assemblyai.com/twist today.
But this is just one of the places where I have no patience. I honestly try to love pretty much everybody, but people who are opposed to nuclear power and people who are opposed to self-driving are my mortal enemies, along with the Dutch. Those are the three categories I can't take. And so I just it makes me so mad when they put
cones
on.
You can say it. They're the R word, reductionist.
That's like, well, Jason, that's an interesting point. We're going to move on now from that comment. No. Reductionist, we'll take it.
I felt like some people are trying to bring the R word back.
Ignore my friend here. Just ignore.
You don't need to. You don't need to bring the R word back.
Reductionists, yes. They are slow downerists, if you will.
Yes, they're decels. You know, and so I believe this WeRide, which is an obvious Waymo knockoff. It looks exactly like the Waymo. It's got the same exact design. This is proof positive, I think, that this technology is going to be commoditized at a very, very fast rate.
Yes.
And I was driving my Tesla in Austin. I shipped it to Austin. And I was doing some 30 to 45 minute rides. So I said, okay, you know, let me just see if I can get the whole way there.
Yeah.
The pickup and the drop off is super challenged when you're not in a contained space like San Francisco or a city, because driveways, parking lots, like these things are hard to navigate, you know.
Okay.
And people have gates at their houses, or you're getting to the airport. It's super complicated. So I think self-driving's got a lot of work to do. I won't call it the last mile. I'll call it the last 100 yards.
Yeah.
The 100-yard problem is real. Putting that aside, I would say one intervention, and I'm on the 12.3 software, so I got to get 12.4 and 5. I don't know why I'm not upgraded yet. But I think, you know, and watching the things online, it seems like you're going to have one or two interventions every hour or something, which means they're getting very close.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a deployment problem. And then if five people do get there, already Uber did a deal for 100,000 BYD electric vehicles with self-driving. 100,000 of them, like, already. And now BYD might have big tariffs coming into the US, but around the world, globally, they don't have that. So, you know, you're going to have BYD, Waymo. Waymo already has a deal with Uber. I don't know if Cruise is going to get back into it. You have this company that we just found out about, that's a knockoff company. And there could be maybe 7 to 10 people who get there. And then whoever wants to win is either going to have to build an at-scale competitor to Uber and Lyft and DoorDash, or sell to DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft. I think half of them are going to do the latter, which means the real impact we're going to see, Alex, is going to be the number of rides in ride sharing, autonomous and regular, is going to boom. And the idea of owning a car is going to become kind of silly.
Yes.
Like, and right now, I think the total number of rides in the United States, I'd say the ones that are done by Uber or Lyft versus private citizens, you know, or other means in cars, is probably 1 or 2%.
Yeah, I was going to say 1 to 100, you know, but I mean,
1 to 100. Yeah.
Once you have self-driving, even if it just doubles it, that takes us to 2 out of 100. So there's going to be a couple of fun tipping points. One is, when is the majority of Uber's domestic rides done autonomously versus with a human driver? And then when is self-driving the majority of all rides in the US? That's going to be much longer. But both the things I'm very excited about. You nailed it, though. The point about these companies is, when can they build out a fleet that uses their technology to really try to capture a bunch of the market before someone else does. So WeRide is not a great company financially. They actually had less revenues last year than in the year before. And in the first half of this year, they shrank again. So why is everyone piling in to give them, you know, $500-600 million in this IPO? I think it's because they want to build out their massive robo-taxi fleet. I think this IPO is literally a fundraise to put the cars on the road, because their tech goes from L2, level two self-driving, to level four, which in theory actually gets beyond even occasional human intervention. Now, that's what their prospectus says. I'm not endorsing that, but that's the claim. So you take an L4 level company that has self-driving revenues, but autonomous robotaxi revenues that are minimal, put a pile of capital behind it. To me, it smells like a build out. And that's why I think they're going to try to win. But as we've discussed, the Chinese market is relatively self-contained. So, you know, Waymo in the US, Tesla in the US, Cruise in the US. Jason, I'm so excited. It's going to be so much fun.
And, you know, right now, the number of people dying in car accidents, 30, 40,000 a year, has stayed static. So you wonder, why is that staying static when people are drinking and driving less? Mm-hmm. Turns out, still a ton of people drinking and driving.
Yes.
There's also distracted driving.
Yes.
And so distracted driving, I think, is keeping our death toll high, while drinking and driving might have gone down a bit, because people who are drunk are like, you know what? Unless I'm Justin Timberlake and I'm really smashed in the Hamptons, I'm going to call an Uber. You know, Justin Timberlake's suffering. I don't think he can afford an Uber at this point. He would much rather get pulled over by the cops and get arrested and lose his license and cause a massive PR thing than, God forbid, one of his friends pulls him aside and says, hey, dummy.
Right.
No need to kill anybody in your car. There's this new Uber thing and Lyft. You can just press a button.
Yep.
Or you're Justin frickin' Timberlake. Anybody at the club will drive you home in your own car, and then they'll take an Uber and you take a selfie with them. Wake up, dude.
Well, I mean, the other side of that is, once you reach a level of fame and success and wealth, pick a category or power, you do begin to think that you are, in fact, different, and different rules apply. And I think keeping your head is the hardest part of that. And Justin Timberlake's been a name for what feels like my entire life. Well, he screwed up. He did give us a good meme, though, with the, this is going to ruin the tour. What tour? The world tour. I've seen that repeated on the internet. What? I really enjoyed that.
Just put some numbers on it. Federal Highway Administration says Americans take over 1 billion trips a day in cars, 400 billion trips annually. And Uber reported $7.6 billion trips. This is 2022 data, so it's much higher. But anyway, about 2 billion rides in the U.S. a couple years ago. So maybe they're at 3 or 4 billion rides in the U.S., which is exactly 1%. You nailed it, Alex. So,
well, I mean, you and I are both very close. It's funny to me, because I bet you for some people it's 0000, and for some people it's 85%. So there's sure, a class of folks out there who don't like driving, like myself, who will take an Uber when it's raining because I'm not going to walk, or my wife's gone, or whatever. And I bet, you know, I will go more places. So this is not just a replacement. It's going to boost the total TAM for Uber. So I guess if Uber nails the self-driving use case, this feels like a 2014 conversation. If Uber nails the self-driving use case, man, their market's huge.
Yeah.
Just astoundingly large.
2007, I think, is when that DARPA, you know, self-driving contest was kind of going on, and everybody was sort of laughing about the cars driving off the side of the road. And we're here 15 years later, and I just took a ride from like the lake in Austin, Lake Travis, mm-hmm, to the airport with one intervention. And now the pickup and the drop-off would not have worked in either of these cases. So yeah, the last 100 yards have to be solved, which I think is going to be brute force, like, okay, this is how this airport works. Exactly what Uber wound up doing. They had to like define each airport manually, mm-hmm, send somebody there, take pictures of things, explain to you where you go, kind of thing. On highways, I wish people were forced to use level two on all highways. I think level two, which is the car takes over two functions for you, should be required on highways, which is lane assist. It keeps you in your lane. And then adaptive cruise control, which means it doesn't let you plow into the person in front of you. Those two things, I don't know why those aren't by default turned on in all cars.
So, Jason, do you ever drive a manual transmission?
Sure. Love it.
I learned to drive on Oregon logging roads in my dad's F-250. You know, great car to learn to drive on because it had enough torque that you really couldn't kill it. And so you could really learn to shift on it. It was great. My dad will probably never stop driving stick. And so when I think about L2 and how it's just obvious it is for you and I that everyone should have this, I think we just got to keep in mind that car culture is so core to the identity of so many folks, and they're just not going to let go of it. Like, It doesn't matter to me. I don't derive any of my self-worth from it, but I'm just one person. So I'm sympathetic to the other side of that, but you're correct. But I'm going to move us along, talk about two of your favorite things, Generation Bet and also the world of AI, because Polymarket and Perplexity are teaming up. And did you know, Mr. Galganis?
Yes.
That Polymarket is built on Ethereum.
I did not know that. So people are placing real money bets on this prediction market.
Mm-hmm.
On, you know, is Biden going to drop out, or is
JD
Vance going to get replaced, or who's going to be the VP pick? All these kind of real world events. Politics comes to mind now, but other things can come up like sports and stock markets and all kinds of other prop bets. But they use Ethereum as the ledger, is what you're saying?
So this was news to me. I was prepping some notes on Perplexity, the AI search engine, Polymarket, the prediction market. They have a partnership. So I was just digging in and I saw that they're based on Ethereum. So I went to Dune, which is the blockchain analytics service that we all know and use. And I pulled a graph of how much people are using Polymarket over time. And then also the total transaction volume that's flowing through it. This is the Polymarket daily volume chart. But Jason, isn't it cool to see a startup that's raised a bunch of money and have public data of how it's doing? This is the coolest thing, because now I can see the inside information. And as you can tell, doing quite well lately. Total volume has absolutely gone through the roof. And if you look at daily active traders, it's also showing quite a lot of just very strong performance.
Amazing.
I love it.
Yeah, it's not quite a hockey stick, but it's getting close. I think this is really interesting. I love the idea of people placing bets. They'll get things wrong. You know, people thought Shapiro was going to be the VP candidate, not Walls.
Yes.
So why? Well, it turns out like it's a very personal pick that an individual made. It's like somebody picking what dessert they want to have. Like, this could be the best dessert at the restaurant, but the person might have a preference for, you know,
tiramisu over the sorbet.
Exactly. You know, everybody could say like, hey, this sorbet, they're known for it. It's world class. They buy their tiramisu from the bakery down the street. It's mid. Doesn't matter. Kamala Harris wants to have the tiramisu. She's going to have it. So that was a perfect learning moment for the markets, which is, even though this person is the consensus, this is a choice that is not based on the consensus or what makes the most sense necessarily. What makes the most sense for an individual.
Yes.
And so that's good to learn. And this is the Generation Bet concept, which I'll debut here for the first time. You helped me. I gave a talk at KPMG last week, and it was in Park City. They asked me to do it. I don't do a lot of these folks. I get paid a ton of money to do them, but I only do them for friends like once or twice a year. But I asked Alex to help me out on it. Thank you for the help. And one of the themes, you know, that we've been working on here on the show, static team size, where teams stay the same size. We talked about that a whole bunch. We're trying to codify them. One of the ones I want to codify here is Generation Bet, like Generation X or Generation Y, Generation Bet. What is Gen Bet? It's the people who grew up on Robinhood, buying crypto, NFTs, and prediction markets, and Prize Picks, you know, and what's the other one? That's
sports betting.
Draft Kings and sports betting and all this. This group of individuals, and I was interacting with some people in the audience. This is like serious people, 200 really senior executive, like CEO, VC, leaders of public companies, all kinds of stuff. And I said, listen, how many of you have a child who is wagering a bunch? They're in their 20s or 30s, and you're a little bit concerned about their stock trading, options trading, NFT trading, crypto trading, sports betting, or prediction markets. Man, a lot of people in the room came up. So I did a little audience work. And I was talking to this one woman, and I said, well, why are you concerned? And she said, well, you know, it's like he's really into it. And I said, is he up or down? She said, well, so he was down, but now he's way up. And I said, okay. What you've experienced with your 27-year-old or something is this individual is now a financial, like, it's almost like they went to World War II and they came back as vets. This is a financial vet now. Like, they have scar tissue. They have trauma. They have PTSD. They bet on the Jets or the Nets or some horrible sports franchise. They bought, you know, NFTs that went to zero. This is what makes a great investor later in life. The people who become great poker players are the ones who examine their play and have made stupid plays and are grinding their teeth at night, staring at the ceiling saying, why did I shove it all in with my set when there were four hearts on the board? I overvalued my set. It's obvious in a four-handed hand or a three-handed hand,
Somebody has to have a heart.
Yeah, somebody's got that flush. You bet into a textured board because you got, you know, too attached to your set of sevens, like, dummy. That's generation bet. And this group, when they become 50 years old in 20 years, Marron, they're going to be able to place bets and wagers and investments. And I don't know what percentage of the population it is who does, let's say, three or more of these things. Like, they do crypto, stocks, and prediction markets. They do prediction markets, stocks, and sports. Somebody who does, I would say, three of the four that we've outlined here, you will have a brain designed to place bets. You'll be, in other words, you'll be a venture capitalist or entrepreneur.
Yes.
What do you
think? And I'm just going to throw in a comma because some folks don't learn and they don't turn it into a skill and they end up not, broke. And then also, like, gambling addiction's not a joke. That said, in the same way that I, a recovering alcoholic, don't want to ban everyone else from drinking, I think we can discuss the harms and the benefits in the same sentence without being contradictory. So I agree with you. At the same time, if you do find yourself sports betting away your entire paycheck, help, get some friends, go to a meeting, take care of yourself. But I do think, though, that the financialization of everything is changing culture. And it's also, I think, changing or it's being changed by people who are younger at the lower socioeconomic strata who don't see a way to traditionally grind their way up and are looking for a way to short circuit things.
A quick fix.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be dismissive of it because, you know, if you're a trader and you get a 10 bagger, you know, are we saying that's a quick fix to your career?
Nah.
But I think people just look at the prices of houses that have gone up, 50% in the last 5 years, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, my paycheck's gone up by 4%. I'm getting owned by inflation. There's no way I'm going to grind my student loans out and then grind up a deposit, then grind out a house. So I'm going to go buy what NFTs are cool these days? Do we still like punks? Punks? Crypto punks?
No, I think they're all going to zeros.
Oh. Fine. I'm going to bet on Tim Walz being the next, you know, Democratic VP candidate or whatever it is. And I'm going to, you know, lay it out there and hopefully get a way forward. People used to make fun of people who are poor betting on the lottery. But if you go back to Colin Powell's autobiography and his parents' discussion of their, I think, lottery when they let them buy a house.
Yeah.
It was a way to essentially have an option on a different future that was very different from their trajectory. And I hear it. I get it. It makes sense to me. I do it.
Well, and also this kind of thinking leads people, and you're right, listen, some people are going to get addicted, they're going to do stupid things, and there's the risk of ruin, and you know, if you do it with the wrong individuals, you could wind up, you know, with your legs broken.
Yes,
not good, right? And so people can take it too far, but you know, I think this type of financial literacy is leading people to discover really interesting things. And I think there is another, and I don't know if we've given it a name yet, but I think opting out of capitalism, opt out. I need to come up with a name for this, but it's basically individuals opting out of capitalism or hijacking or hacking capitalism.
Hack cap? Okay.
Hack cap. Yeah. So hack capping is like looking at capitalism, looking at this ecosystem and saying, well, you know, how do I break out of the matrix? And one of the most interesting ones is called FIRE. It's an acronym. It stands for Financial Independence Retire Early. It's a movement defined by people, as you can see here on Investopedia, a really good site for technical definitions of financial terms. Yeah, they do a good job. Essentially, what you want to do is save up some multiple of the money you have, and the FIRE number is 25 times annual expenses. So let's say you're living off of $10,000 a month. That's let's say it's $100,000 a year, $8,000 a month, something like that. $8,000 a month, $100,000 a year. 25 times that annual expense, you know, is $2.5 million. Now you can retire comfortably off that if you withdraw 3-4% during that time. So let's just take $1 million as a number. If you took 4% of your principal out every year and you made 7% in the market, you'd still be topping off like 3% in the average year, but you'd be taking out 4. So your million goes down by $40,000, but it goes up $30,000, or in a good year, it might go up 10%. Bad year, you might, you know, make nothing in the market, so it just goes down that 4%, right? You go from $1 million to $960,000. But you will then taper off after some number of years with, you know, a little bit of money maybe to give to your kids and or to donate to charity, but essentially get to a certain number. It's $1 million or to $2 million for most people living not in a major city with private school. This kind of like financial literacy is, to me, indicative of GenBet and hacking capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan of the FIRE community. There's also Lean FIRE for people who want to do a lower number. There's Fat FIRE for people who like to have a larger total asset
base. Yeah, I'm team Fat FIRE.
Oh, dude, me too. I'm team Fat FIRE because it turns out that I spent $6 on a croissant this morning. And
Was it chocolate or just regular?
No, it was plain, but you squeezed in the butter came out. Oof. My daughter kept coming up from the slide at the park we were at and like stealing. I'm like, honey, this is my breakfast. You can't. She's like, ma. So
you're going to have to learn that you got to double down. And, these kids will just keep. Yeah, they'll eat it later.
For two croissants? I mean, dude, I'm going to go broke.
That is my nuts.
It's so good, though.
Let it sink in, though. $6 for a croissant? I mean, croissant is like what's peasant food. I mean, I know it's a stick of butter, but I mean, it's just
lobster
$2.
Used to be food for prisoners. And now, do you know what I pay for a lobster roll for my wife? Like $30.
I was about to say, in New England, $30. In New York or LA, $40 or $50.
No.
Yeah, I went to New England Lobster Company in San Mateo, and it used to be like, I remember when it was like in high 20s.
Yeah.
Then it was in the 30s. I went the last time, it was like $42 or something. And I was like, whoa.
So $40 for sea bug slathered in cow fat wrapped in a mid roll. Like, I mean, yeah, it's just not.
Makes no sense. We've lost the script.
Oh, right.
But you're right. There's Lean FIRE, Fat FIRE, and then there's also Half FIRE. So I think really interesting one is you could have a Substack. Let's say your Substack makes 50K a year and you have a million. Okay, well, you got the 50K coming in. You pay some taxes. You got 35K. Plus you got 4% off the million. That's 440. Now you're at 75K. So people are, and then that keeps your brain kind of active. So you're working 2 hours a day, three hours a day on your Substack. Sure. 3 hours on your Substack. You make some little bit of money. And so I encourage people to start thinking about this because I think if capitalism is cutthroat the way it is, mm-hmm. and employees are dispensable and employees are not loyal, then you have to protect yourself. And I think GenBet plus hacking capitalism and this FIRE movement and some of these other things, living off grid, being a homesteader, and having your own chickens and eggs and removing expenses. Like, I think this is a natural reaction to capitalism moving into its next phase, which I think is going to be a level of efficiency in capitalism that's going to be disturbing to experience for people who participate in it on all sides.
Where we're seeing this in a lot of places, that there was the idea of lying flat in China. There's also the use of the phrase garbage time from the NBA that's being used in China to describe the garbage years. People who are just thinking there's not a upside to grinding for 20 years, like they won't be able to make a better, space for their children to do better than they did. And I think a lot of the things we're describing are actually pretty anti-birthright now that I think about it. Because if you're trying to structure your life to not need more, you're not having children. And, you were talking about, part-time FIRE. And I was like, oh, I could have done that now.
Yeah.
If I didn't have a second child.
Yeah.
So you should be really glad that I'm having two, because my second child is brought us together.
Need this job.
I do need this job because that's an extra 3 more years of nanny. And that's like 12 more years of private school. Oh,
God. Yeah. Yeah. It's something to consider. Yeah.
I'm bringing us back. So started off with Polymarket and Perplexity teamed up. Just quickly wrapping this up. Polymarket has raised $74 million. Perplexity has raised $165 million. It's a billion-dollar company. And the thing that I wanted to throw out there for people who are tracking the AI startups and I guess the GenBet startups, I think we'll just call them that, is the amount of deals they're doing. So in the last couple of months, just this year, Arc and Perplexity, January. SK Telecom and Perplexity, February. Perplexity and its work with nonprofits, June. Perplexity and publisher deals, July. Uber and Perplexity, August. And then also this year, Polymarket plus Substack, Polymarket plus MoonPay, and then most recently, Polymarket plus Perplexity. These companies are wheeling and dealing for distribution, and I think just generally build mind share. I think it's brilliant. I don't know if they're going to become the next $10 billion companies, but I do like the pace at which they're shipping and the pace at which they're signing contracts with other companies. I think it's just smart.
Yeah, I think Perplexity has got a serious problem. I think, I don't know if you saw, but ChatGPT, OpenAI has a Perplexity killer they're playing with, and they're going to have their own search engine. And I know that's a big part of Sam Altman's plan historically, because he was really enamored by what I did with Mahalo. He always talked to me about it. Like, he was really into search engines, like anybody in Because if you think about the total amount of search revenue, like a point of search revenue is probably worth $10 billion right now in market cap, right?
Oh, more. Yeah.
So if you take Google's total market cap and they have 90% search share, 90% of their market cap equals 90% of search. Maybe you take out a couple of points for YouTube and other things, but essentially 80% of their market cap is 90% of the value of search. So you just add 10% onto that and you get kind of what search market cap is worth.
So 1.6 trillion divided times by my stupid microphone's in the way of my keyboard because I don't usually need it for this. I'm just going to Wolfram Alpha this, but your point, you know what, your point stands. It's an incredibly valuable thing. Perplexity got some early buzz. My question is, can...
But they're built on top of ChatGPT. And I saw the CEO was like, this is like that whole ChatGPT wrapper issue that people were criticizing.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't own the LLM and the LLM decides that your business is cool and they're going to do it, which, you know, if you haven't been paying attention, Sam Altman's a bit savvy, you know, like pretty strategic guy, perhaps.
Yes.
Some people might say cut throat.
Some people might say. Some people are even saying. Yes. You know, who?
Some
I don't
people
know
might. Well, no. I mean, Ari Emanuel said like,
everybody Ari says
said something like even worse, like this Svengali or something like really.
Yeah.
Trustworthy kind of comments. But, you know, I think that they got a serious problem because I don't think their search is like that much better than using ChatGPT. And then ChatGPT is going to have a search interface. So, man, the difference between asking a question, which is how the default behavior of ChatGPT works right now,
yep,
and just typing a keyword. Right now, if you go to ChatGPT, I have it open right now, and I were to open a window, and I just typed in the word Tokyo.
Tokyo.
It now says like Tokyo, the capital of Japan, and it's some key highlights about Tokyo include, and it's just giving me like, I didn't say a query, right? And when you used to type things in, it used to be like, what would you like to know about Tokyo? So already in 4.0, it's assuming I wanted this information. Culture, landmarks, et cetera, you know? Give me a search result for Tokyo vacation. See what it does. I wonder if it would like give me like a bunch of links, but you know, I think they're going to start, you know, giving you like an actual search result, which would be a comprehensive search result, which is what Naver would do. There was a search engine in Korea called Naver. There's only three markets where And this was part of my inspiration for Mahalo back in the day. So if I were to type in Tokyo vacation in Naver did something called comprehensive search, which was not only would they give you the blue links, but they would then have a video section, which you can see here.
Yeah.
They would have a hotel section. And they called this, I called it comprehensive search when I met with them, because he said, well, we want to give you results that give you everything. And I said, so it's like comprehensive. He said, yeah. So I called it the comprehensive search when I raised money from Sequoia and everything to do Mahalo. And my idea was to do this manually. So take the search results that were there and use Wikipedia style software to do it manually. And, you know, we got a little bit of the way there. We got to 10 million in revenue in search revenue. And then Google just cut off our search traffic. So they wouldn't send any referrers. We lost 90% of our traffic in the Panda. They did this deliberately. There were a bunch of companies that were like eHow, howto.com.
Oh, yeah,
there's a bunch of people who were starting to do really good. Demand Media was the company that kind of taunted Google. And I got really pissed off at the founder of that company because he was like, we figured out how to game the Google algorithm. And Google was excuse me? And they just, and he became public company. And then Google was like, literally 6 months later, they did the Panda update and cut 80% of the traffic to all these sites. And it was just brutal for everybody. But I think Perplexity's toast.
Yeah, but if you're not to rob any bank in the world, the last thing you do is get on Twitter or X and say, I know how to rob every bank in the world. You shut up. You don't. Come on. It's game 101.
No,
come on, people.
No, it's literally the scene from Goodfellas where they do the heist. And then one guy shows up with his wife in a fur coat. Another guy shows up in a new Cadillac. And he's like, I told you guys not to buy anything.
And then they all wake up in the trash compactor.
Exactly.
I want to go back to the will Perplexity get open AI'd with search GPT thing. Because we just posted a couple interviews on the Twist channel, one from Antonio Gracias, Valor Equity Partners, one from Gavin Baker from Atreides Management.
Atreides,
I was there for this, saw him live, loved him. had been waiting for those to go up because they had two nuggets that I wanted to really talk about. And they were about the value of AI models that don't have underlying proprietary data. Gavin said they're the fastest depreciating asset in human history. And Antonio said, and I'm speaking about him describing his firm, not anyone else in any capacity, but he said his firm thinks that if you don't have proprietary data, you're a zero.
Yeah.
And that applies to OpenAI as well, right? Because
they're doing licensing deals. Yeah. They don't have proprietary data.
Perplexity. Right. So I wonder then if the entire like investment into OpenAI is going to yield a search company at the end, almost more than an AI model company.
Well, you know, it depends on if you believe what they say. Like the idea would be that they're going to cap their returns and they just want to get to general AI and then give it to the world is kind of the idea. So, but I don't believe that. I think it's going to become a commercial. I think it's a commercial endeavor, always has been, always will be. So as a commercial endeavor, I do think providing an API is one revenue source. Providing a consumer product is another one, and search could be part of that consumer product.
Sure.
That will either monetize through advertising or the ability to pay for it. I do think open source wins, and I do think the large data sources win, and I think that's where like Reddit is a good pivot here. Reddit had a heck of a quarter. I know their stock was down, but I have seen a bunch of people talking about Reddit having surging traffic, which I thought was like fascinating. And I think they're having a hard time. I think they're having a very hard time monetizing their advertising because the amount of traffic has gone up so much. I also think they have a peculiar, cynical, sophisticated user base that doesn't click on ads as much.
They do not. Yes, that's correct.
As opposed to like a Google search group, which, you know, or Facebook, where you might have like the more dopey users who don't know what's an ad and what's not. Whereas like, yeah, Reddit users are going to be the first ones to put ad blockers on to be cynical about stuff. But their market cap's still cruising around 8-9 billion.
Which I think that's fair.
Yeah, if they have a billion in revenue, nine times revenue is pretty
that's
good.
That's kind of where we are.
Is that right? So tell us about the traffic too.
Yeah, so there's an Adweek story that was discussing essentially, you know, what's going on with Reddit. Two data points. One, publishers are talking about an influx in traffic from Reddit. And the context here, Jason, is that the Reddit CEO, Steve Huffman, has said that it's a real pain in the backside to keep people who don't pay Reddit for access to its data from scraping it as much as they can. And Google has a deal with Reddit, so it's not a huge shock to see quite a lot of Google traffic and Reddit traffic intermingling and so forth. But Reddit is getting very large because the users learned over the last couple of years to type in a Google search and then append Reddit to it.
Yes.
So we take you to a human written result as opposed to an SEO slop bucket. And today an AI generated SEO slop bucket or eight sponsored links. So I'm not shocked to see this from Reddit. I think the company is insanely valuable, but unlocking that value is going to be very tough. I wonder if really you subsidize the users for using it by just letting them play, and then you just make money off of AI deals in the back end. But everyone wants Reddit, and most of them don't want to pay it right now, which I think is poor form from companies that have, last time I checked, effectively unlimited money.
If you have any Reddit content in your LLM, you know, and you're commercializing it, yeah, I think you need to pay. If you had like a couple of, you know, the hack around this is if a user had an LLM on their desktop and they do a search and their computer then loads 10 Reddit pages and gives them an answer, that's totally legal, by the way. What you do on your desktop is your business. So I do think the way they're going to try to defend this is, hey, we didn't scrape Reddit, but this user initiated a search where they said, tell me the 10 best places to go in Tokyo. And maybe you could point me to some Reddit conversations, and then it goes and searches the web, scrapes those pages. Now, if they do it on their server, that's one thing. If they do it on the desktop of the user, that's another. So it's going to get very granular here. But I do think Reddit is an incredible asset, and I've been thinking about putting a J trade on for it because I do think it could get bought for maybe three times what it's worth right now.
Oh yeah, there's no way you could pick it up for 15, right? Reddit would never sell because I think they know what they're sitting on. And in that same Adweek story that we were talking about a second ago, according to data from SEMrush, which we've all heard of over the years, between August 23 and April 24, readership on Reddit effectively tripled going from 132 million visitors to 346 million monthly visitors. Now, that is, Jason, for the world of online, a hell of a lot of people. 120 million is a lot. 132 million is more. 346 is a bonkers number of total people. So I think that it just shows that the Reddit-Google partnership is going to be very lucrative on both sides. And frankly, now that I'm just talking out loud with you, why the hell wouldn't Google buy Reddit? Oh, well, maybe they can't, you know, Lina Khan, but like...
Yeah, I mean, but when the next administration, it seems like Reid Hoffman told the world, like, and told Kamala, listen, Lina Khan gotta go. And then everybody on the right is like, Lina Khan gotta go.
There's not that many Lina Khan supporters. J.D. Vance is like the only one that I can think of. That's
that was
super
really weird bedfellows. Yeah, he. I do understand like the monopolistic, like we talked about this, like there should be a three-tiered structure.
Yep.
Over a $1 trillion company, you can't buy nothing, or it's very, very restricted. You can buy something like if it had very small market share. You know, mid-tier, you get some scrutiny and maybe some rules, and then under 250, I'm for free for all.
Woo! Yeah, I agree with that.
FF, like literally, like what do they call it when you play Fortnite? Battle Royale.
Yes.
Battle Royale under 250 billion. So like, if you know Uber's at 140 and Airbnb's at 100 billion, they can F around. Free for all, Battle Royale. They want to merge. They want to buy DoorDash, Lyft, this, that, the other thing. Go for it. Have fun. Mazel tov. Yeah. If Reddit and Uber want to combine forces, who cares?
Who cares?
Reddit and Instacart. I don't care. Lyft and Instacart. Let them go sync their ships
apron
together.
And quantum computing. Let's just throw some
whatever. Blue Apron and Reddit. Whatever. It does not matter.
Right.
It's not material. So Battle Royale. And then everybody, because who knows? What if like a Reddit and a DoorDash? What if Uber,
mm-hmm.
Reddit,
mm-hmm.
and Airbnb and DoorDash became one company? Now you got like all these hundreds of millions of users. You've got all this on-demand activity. And the combined companies were 200 billion, 250 billion. Okay, sure. Now they have to stop buying stuff. Now they get a little scrutiny. But now you got this juggernaut with a common user base. It's like, whoa, you know, could be interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, you would have some interesting synergies with the integration of Uber Eats and DoorDash. That would actually be pretty fascinating from a, Lyft could never get into deliveries at that point. That'd be brutal.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And whenever we do
corporate combination bingo, right? It's always a very fun experiment because you start to imagine these really weird companies that you could, if you want to do, in fact build. All right, I want to, for everyone out there who's like Jason and Alex, stop talking about other things and talk about venture capital. Sure. I have some data for us. I want to talk briefly, Jason, about Europe. We were all watching the Olympics. Mm. Everyone's seen beautiful, beautiful Paris. Europe's much larger than just the City of Lights. And there was a fundraise that really caught my eye. So how much interaction have you had with Balderton, the venture capital firm, over the years?
Zero.
Okay. They just put together $1.3 billion for two funds, 615 early stage, 685 growth. Sifted.eu said it was, quote, the largest ever combined early stage and growth fundraise dedicated to European startups. And I just kind of want to get, what's your gut reaction to hearing that? Does it matter? Does it not matter? Is it a big number, small number?
Listen, $1 billion is a big number. And the European consumers have money. They're well-heeled. These are, you know, the challenge, of course, is if these are European companies going after a European market, is it's a fragmented, you know, market. And so it's like South America in that, you know, you got 100 million German speakers, you got 50 million people in Paris and Paris speakers, you got 5 million in Norway, 20 million in Sweden, 5 million in Ireland. I mean, these are very disparate, interesting, different cultures. So
sure.
Can you make, you know, Uber or Airbnb work across all of them? You can, but it's certainly not as efficient as making Uber work for 350 million Americans, you know, or a billion people in India or China. So there are challenges to that space. Obviously, we've talked about regulation is the other big challenge. So it's really hard to get a big outcome in Europe, and Europe is stopping a lot of the big outcomes. So I think there's probably less competition for venture there, which means, you know, having an Andreessen Horowitz of that area, somebody with $1 billion or $2 billion to go do some big deals, could be a good bet, because I think a lot of people are dismissive of that market because of the restrictions and the fact that it's not a monoculture. It's many different cultures.
Right. But that is like essentially the conventional wisdom is that there's too much regulation, it's too fragmented, et cetera. The things you just said, and I think all those are valid. That's right. Why when I saw the Baldur's number, I'm like, huh? That's not what I heard. So I pulled some data for us, Jason. This is showing total venture capital disbursed, invested in Europe over time. And clearly 2021, 2022, just bonkers years, cut them out. If you look at the pace of this year, this is through Q2, we're actually going to surpass 2020 in Europe this year. That is more bullish than I anticipated. Yeah. And it's not going to be quite as big as 2023 by current norms, but we are seeing a lot of money still flow into European companies. And the thing that I can kind of point to is, one, France and AI is doing a thing, but like Spotify is worth 60, 70 billion. Klarna is going to go public soon. Yeah, I think that there is juice in those legs. I think there's more than we give them credit for sitting in the United States. And I wonder what we're getting wrong, because the conventional wisdom versus the data, to me, there's a dissonance there. And I don't know what part of our analysis is not nailing it.
It's a very weird market, because if you look at the unicorns, they were centralized in the Nordics. Very strange, right? Like, why is that? I've heard a lot of different theories of why in Europe they're clustered in Sweden, you know, Denmark, et cetera. I don't have an exact answer for that. What people have told me is that people are the education system, the focus level, the design skills, like product design skills, are very high there, and people are very industrious. And it's cold and dark, and people work more, and they stay in offices longer. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but if you've been to Spain or Italy, pretty great place to be outside and go have a drink and get some food and hit the beach. You've been to Norway and Sweden, freaking cold.
Yeah.
And you want to go in and get some soup. So I do think climate, as crazy as that sounds, and lifestyle, is a driver. Now, you know, when you look and you talk about San Francisco versus New York and Miami specifically, one of the things I've heard from venture capitalists in my career, and remember, I started in New York as the Silicon Valley reporter covering a trade, I had started a trade publication specifically about that market, was New York's just too much damn fun. And, you know, there's a reason to leave the office at 6 or 7 o'clock, because you could go to a really great restaurant and go to a club after and then show up for work at 10 o'clock. As opposed to working from 9 till 11 p.m. In San Francisco in the Bay Area, as you know, you know, if you're in Palo Alto and you try to get food at 10 o'clock, I mean, In-N-Out Burger closes at 10 o'clock. Like, the fast food restaurants are closed by 11 o'clock.
By 9. I mean, Palo Alto rolls up the sidewalks at 7:30 p.m. Like,
you're done.
Sunnyvale, downtown Sunnyvale, is like 9 buildings on one street. Like,
yes,
because I've spent a lot of time there. There's nothing going on. It is work or sit on your couch.
Basically, right. Yeah. You know, you can just either, you're going to go do fentanyl on Turk, or you're going to work at Google. One or the other.
Very similar life trajectories in terms of intellectual output.
Yes.
I do want to, sorry, I couldn't resist.
But anyway, I do think that's part of it in Europe is, you know, if you are trying to get, and this is one of the themes that you and I have been working on related to this sort of hacking capitalism, is like, who actually wants to work hard? Who values lifestyle? Who lives to work and who works to live? I can tell you the assistants that we have in Manila, in a, you know, from Athena, go to athenawow.com, get a month off or something like that. You know, you go to, work with those folks.
Yeah.
They are like, Nikki and Rage on our team are like, I need more work. Can I do more work? Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. I mean, it's like literally being in the 1950s, like, in terms of like as an employer where people are like thrilled to have the job. Now you juxtapose that with Canadians, US workers, European workers. People in Europe are like, I need 8 weeks off. I need 6 weeks off. Like I'm not, and I don't want to check my email after 5 o'clock. Like there's a law in Europe, and I don't know which countries are actually doing this, if it ever got passed in the EU, but there were passing laws, and I believe France is the first country to do it. Employers cannot require employees to check their email on the weekend or answer the phones or whatever. In other words, when you're off the clock, you're off the clock. It's reasonable, But it's also reasonable that people who want to advance their career could work on the weekends, which is what I told one of our researchers recently. I was like,
yeah,
do you take this job seriously? And if you do, if I was you, I'd do 2 hours every Saturday or Sunday, checking your email and checking in with all the founders who are in your portfolio, because you only have 25. And in 2 hours, you could email, you know, half of them this weekend and half of them next weekend. And that's how you would have an edge on other venture capitalists in our firm, and our firm would have an advantage over other firms.
And now on Sundays, high leverage output, you can get so much done. Just on the, we have to go away in a second, but sure. I'm going to just squeeze this in. On your point about climate and culture, the reason why in the United States, coffee culture has such a Seattle basis to it is because it sucks to live there because it's raining all the time and you need a mid-grade stimulant to do anything. And I say this as a guy from the Pacific Northwest, I say it with love. And then going back to your point about the Nordics and their blistering climate in the cold versus hot direction, why is there so much amazing heavy and death metal from that area? It's because they are sad and they are drunk and they are in the basement and they have a guitar and good music flows out of it. So you can see connections. I'll just say though, again, talk about France. It is the AI hub of Europe, and I have some other data from Pitchbook in front of me here that it is raising far more than even Israeli companies in terms of the total AI focused capital flowing into it. So on continental Europe, making Israel in there as Pitchbook does, it's the leader. So something's going on. You know, someone's going to be slightly wrong here, and I'm curious. But we got to go away. Friends and family, we are back. We are doing news. We have lots to talk about. The world is so interesting.
And we'll take one question from the audience, maybe two.
Bobby V has a question for Jason. I'm going to just paraphrase this for you a little bit. Given the AI conversation that we had, would you invest any of your own personal money into an AI model-ish company? And if so, which one is your favorite?
I definitely would not. I think because they're overvalued. And I think the winner is going to be open source. I would invest in a company like Hugging Face or somebody who built support tools and a stack around an open source project. So if somebody took Llama from Facebook and they said, hey, J-Cal, I want to come to the accelerator. Here's my idea. I take Llama and I'm going to fine tune it and build a collection of tools around it for people who are working in audio and video. Or people who are working with accounting, or, you know, and build some sort of open source extension to it and a hosting product or whatever. Yeah, sure, maybe something that was picks and tools and shovels based upon an open source product and in a language model. I would do something like that. I also think consulting firms, like there's two ways to make money in the world. Equity value, Alex, you know, and we talk about stocks going public and getting bought. And Lina Khan's reign of terror on the venture industry. But then there's another thing. It's called cash flow, cash flowing businesses. If you're three really smart cats in, you know, and have the ability to fine tune a language model, et cetera, starting a services firm where you charge ungodly amounts of money and you have 10 developers in Ukraine, India, offshore, wherever, that cost you $35,000 a year each, and they're crushing it, and you're paying them twice what they got paid at their job locally. You could go start charging, you know, for multi-million-dollar engagements to work with companies that are trying to figure out how to deploy and implement the software. And that's picks and shovels. There was a company called Razorfish, my friend Jeff and Craig started.
Yes.
In New York. And there was another one, agency.com. Like, those companies for 5 years, agency businesses, they wound up being bought by the larger agencies like BBDO or whatever, like those giant roll-ups are in the advertising business. Those companies were charging $250,000 to plan people's websites, and then they would charge $5 to $25 million to build their websites.
Philip Kaplan talked about this in Eft Companies. Yeah.
Yes. So there's just a huge, huge opportunity there.
The thing I'm going to throw in there is that if you ever get tired of me and ask me to not keep coming on the show, I'm just going to go ghostwrite for VCs. That's my version of that.
You could do it. Yeah, I think they would pay a lot of money. I always wonder who writes Aaron from Aaron Levy Box's tweets, and he told me he does. And I was like, no way.
I believe that because
He's got to have a team. There's some group of people in a room helping him brainstorm them. He's just too good.
Anyone else?
Either that or he should quit and be a comedian.
Anyone else, I would agree with you, but Aaron Levy, I think is actually, I think he's that guy. I just think he's smart and nice. And I think that combination plays well on social media. All right, we got to get out of here. We got to go.
We'll see
be
you
back,
all
everybody. More news
next
coming.
Next time. Bye-bye.